The majority of people who leave prison end up back in prison. The majority. What if I told you there was a program out there that had a 100% success rate in reintegrating people who had a life of crime and they're trying to get back into the world? Well, we did find that. And as we dig into that story, we're gonna uncover secrets for your success and thriving, and more beautifully, how God takes your most profound failures and brokenness, even the things that were your fault, and turns that into a redemptive story. All that today on The Chris Stefanik Show. Welcome to The Chris Stefanik Show. We are here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with the joy that God made you for. Missionaries of Joy, thank you. It's because of you that we're able to do this. If you're not a Missionary of Joy, click below this video, become one. Get off the sidelines. Get into the mission with us. Also, if you want daily inspiration, click below, sign up for the Daily Anchor. It's how we bless you every day. Absolutely no strings attached. This episode is sponsored in part by EWTN. You can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming. Link below in the show notes. Today, I'm going to talk to a man who spent 20 years plus behind bars. He found redemption. There's a monastic movement happening within prisons. That's mind-blowing. And his own story of redemption has led to him giving his life to helping other people reintegrate back into the world in a way that's going to challenge you and your own comfort zone. So I'm honored to be here today with Jim Bloom. Jim, thank you so much for being on, man.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Yeah, I've been watching you and what you do through Barbara, through your sister, and then following your ministry for many years. And I love redemption stories, man. It's the ultimate comeback.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Like when God takes the worst thing we can imagine in our lives and uses that very thing to make us a blessing. I want to talk about how God's done that through you. But first, when you got your prison sentence, when the gavel, you know, hit and you heard the words that you were going to jail, what's that feel like? I mean, maybe I'm sorry if this is kind of a crazy question, but what's going through your head in those moments?
Yeah.
Or is it just pure adrenaline? I mean, what's happening on the inside?
Yeah, so it's, you know, tremendous amount of fear.
Yeah.
And just being overwhelmed and not, I mean, you know, I was sentenced to 32 years. And at the time I was 26. I hadn't even been on the planet for 32 years. And I'm thinking, I don't even know what that means to go to prison for 32 years. And so I was just blown away. And, you know, watching, you know, after the gavel comes down, then they come and they put handcuffs on you to take you back to the jail cell. And I'm watching my mother cry. And that's very hard.
Oh, yeah.
And there's nothing that I can do, and there's nothing that she can do, and there's nothing anybody can do. I mean, it's just, it's just this new power that has come into your life that is requiring something of you that you can't fix, and it blows you away. Blew me away. Yeah.
Does your sense of self and identity change in that moment, or when you're in prison? Did you feel condemned? Did you feel like you yourself were less than? Did you feel or repentant in that moment? Like was it a waking up moment?
No, not at that time. Later. Yeah, I was still, first of all, overwhelmed. I was in denial about my crime at that time. I was still telling people that I was innocent.
And you believed it?
No. I mean, okay. I knew I was guilty.
Okay.
But I was still putting on this face and this lie. And so I was focused on that. I was trying to get myself out of this situation still, even after the conviction. My intent was to appeal right away, which I did.
Yeah.
And obviously that didn't work out. But it was, Chris, I was an arrogant fool when I went to prison. I was a stupid kid that thought I thought I had the world by the tail.
Hey there, I just wanted to share something really important with you guys real quick. You know what's crazy? This entire show, every episode, Every conversation, every life changed, only happens because of our supporters. The Chris Stefanik Show is powered by people like you, people who believe in spreading the joy of the gospel. Now here's the deal. Each year we reach millions of people, but there are millions more that have not received not just the good, but the great news of the gospel. We want to reach those people, walk with them, and that's where you come in. When you become a monthly donor, a missionary of joy, you're not just donating, you're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring the hope, truth, and joy of the gospel to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a missionary of joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series, including Living Joy, Rise, Renewed, Fearless, and more. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. The truth is, the gospel is too good to keep to ourselves. If this show or our work has encouraged you, challenged you, or strengthened your faith, imagine how many more lives we can change together. Don't just watch the mission, fuel it. Click the link below and become a monthly donor today. It'll be the best investment you make this year.
I thought I was going to fix this situation still, and I thought that somehow I was going to be vindicated and move on with my life. And
wow.
And it wasn't until later that repentance came and change came. I had grown up in a Catholic family until I was about 6 or 7, but I left the church, you know, very young. And through my teenage years, I became very, I had kind of a Gnostic worldview. And I really thought that, I didn't know it was called that at the time because I didn't know anything about theology then, but I thought that I could think my way out of anything, that somehow I had the power to transform my life and the world through the power of my whatever, spirit, my being, my intellect, whatever it was. And I thought I was going to fix this situation somehow.
Wow.
And then I began to realize, you know, in the coming months, I can't fix this. Nothing's going to change this. This is out of my power to do anything about. But it took some time for that realization to come.
So it took months in prison to basically humble you.
Yeah. When I went to prison, I did immediately begin to pray again. And I remembered the Catholic prayers of my youth. I began to pray the rosary and other things. I began to read the Bible. So I began seeking answers, but I didn't have the answers immediately. And it took time for that to you know, it was not an instantaneous conversion or transformation or repentance. It took a long time for me to wrap my head around this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, my grandfather was a very devout man. And I didn't actually know him very well, my grandfather, but, you know, I had seen him at holidays and things like that. But I reached out to him. I began to write him letters and ask him questions about the faith because my parents, they were Catholic, but they weren't really, I don't know. He was sort of the expert as far as I was concerned. So I reached out to Grandpa.
From prison.
From prison. We wrote some letters back and forth, and I began to ask questions. And when he didn't have answers to the questions I was asking anymore, he sent me books. He'd send a book and say, look, I don't know the answer to your question. Read this book.
Wow.
And then he sent more books. And eventually, I started asking for books. You know, I would get a catalog with the book, and I'd say, oh, this looks interesting. And so I'd ask him, could I get this one? After a while, he contacted a bookstore here in town, and he said, my son or my grandson's going to write and ask you for books. You send him anything he wants, and you send me the bill. And I read, in those first couple of years, 2 or 3 years in prison, I read probably 15 or 20 books a month. Biographies.
Are you serious?
Yeah, biographies, history, theology. I was looking for answers. And I read my way back into the Catholic Church.
It
was an intellectual conversion at first. Understanding the history of... I read the Bible not knowing that the Bible was full of history. I thought it was just like a book of rules or wise sayings or something.
Wow.
I had no idea. And I found all this history there, and like the history of the world, I read Warren Carroll's History of Christendom alongside with the Bible, and I was like, wow, this is actual real stuff. These are real people. Abraham was a guy, right? And Moses was a guy. And they actually had these struggles in this life, and I never knew that. I didn't learn that, you know, because I'd left the church very young.
That's a real incredible grace. I would imagine a lot of people who end up in prison, if they're there because they're agnostic, arrogant, they have a worldview that's scrubbed of God, and they think, I could think my way through anything. Mm. And you find yourself caught. I'd imagine a lot of people just get harder and more angry.
Yeah.
Instead, it brought you to your knees to a place of, okay, I need to find the meaning of life.
It did.
And I grew up in prison. Need to find some hope.
Yeah.
You grew up in prison.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I went in just this arrogant, stupid kid who you know, and I was in prison for 20 years. And I really was transformed during that time. I was confirmed. I became an oblate of St. Benedict, which is like a third order Benedictine.
Incredible. That's your next level Catholic in prison.
We had this priest who was coming, and he was a Benedictine monk from Holy Cross Abbey down in Canyon City. And at some point I had heard about the Liturgy of the Hours, so I got my grandpa to send me the 4-volume set of the Liturgy of the Hours, and I couldn't figure out how to use it. I was like, I don't understand this book. So I brought it to Father Lewis Kirby. It was his name, a great man. And I said, can you teach me how to pray this? And he said, sure. So he showed me how to do morning prayer and evening prayer.
Wow.
And then when I saw him again, he said, would you be interested in being an oblate of St. Benedict? And I said, what's that? And so he explained it to me. I was the third Benedictine oblate in prison in the country. That was a new thing at that time. There were only two other men that Father Kirby had brought in as oblates. Now there are hundreds of oblates across the country.
You're kidding?
Yeah, no, yeah. When Holy Cross Abbey shut down, Father Kirby moved to St. Benedict's Abbey in Atchison, Kansas, and brought the prisoner oblate program with him there. And now it's run by Father Matthew Habiger. And a layman by the name of Craig Cummins, still in very close contact with them, but they've got hundreds of oblates across the country at this point.
So there's a quiet monastic movement happening inside of prisons.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you're an oblate in a prison, you're living pretty much a kind of a monk life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
Right. They even call
it something I wouldn't have thought of.
They even call it a cell. The monks and the prison both call it a cell that you live in, right? So it's an amazing thing.
How did that line up with your process of interior conversion, becoming humble, taking ownership for your crime?
Yeah.
Admitting it to people? Was there a time at which you said, you know, Mom, Dad, look, I did commit the crime I'm here for?
Like, absolutely.
How did that all sync up? And how did you find the courage, frankly, through your faith, to be that honest with yourself and other people?
Yeah. So what happened was I appealed my case.
Yeah.
And my case was actually overturned on a technicality. So I got back out of prison after 2 years. And I was slated to go back to trial. When your case is overturned, then they say, well, you have to have a new trial.
Yeah.
And so, at that point, I knew I would be convicted again. So I took a plea bargain at that point. For probation, okay. But in the meantime, I was having a conversation with my family, and they said, look, we want you to come clean with us. We want you to tell us what happened.
Wow.
And it was sort of an intervention. And I did admit to it at that point, after those couple of years. You know, I was never in denial myself. I always knew that I had done this. And I began to recognize the depth of the harm that I had done. And I wanted to be open about that. And so I did talk with them about it. What happened is I was on probation for a short period of time, and I was revoked from probation and sent back to prison because I wasn't doing well in the treatment program that they had me in.
Wow.
And so that was difficult. Now we've got another sentencing, another gavel, another set of handcuffs, and Mom crying again.
Ugh.
And so I said, I'm done with that. I'm done with watching my mother cry as they haul me away in cuffs. And so I went back, and that's when the journey of that humility really began. That's when I started to the journey of the Benedictine Oblate.
Wow.
That's when before that I had still been sort of defiant for those couple of years, trying to get out of this.
Wow.
And it wasn't really until about 3 or 4 years into this process that I really began to wrap my head around what I had done and why it. You know, why I needed to change.
Mm.
I had been studying informally with these books that Grandpa was sending, and I heard about a place called the Catholic Distance University, and I wrote to them, and they allowed me to start studying there.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were very generous. They allowed me to take classes, and they just build an account. And my mother sent them $50 a month, every month that I was in prison. But they were buying all the books. They were
That's incredible. You know.
And then after
I got
out of
prison.
You got a
degree in theology in prison.
I got a master's degree in theology.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a great spiritual journey. I learned so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm guessing, I mean, for most people, prison is not truly rehabilitative. Why?
Right.
It seems like it's set up, I mean, especially if you're in like a, you know, a really intense prison with a lot of gangs. You know, if you're studying prison systems in California with a lot of gangsters in it, the gang system persists inside the prison.
Yeah.
You need to be part of one of them to survive.
Right.
You could join the Christian or Catholic club maybe within that, and if you're lucky, you're left alone. When you dig into some of these things, it feels a little bit hopeless on the inside that people will go in and they come out like you did, come out actually better. Tell us more about what you saw in that regard. Is my perception correct? Is that
it is? Yeah. Yes. So rehabilitation.
I mean, outside of conversion to faith, that like the way I see the entire world is different. What does rehabilitation even mean? Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's fine. So I mean, there are some educational opportunities available in the prison, but frankly, they're not very good. They'll allow you to study for your GED if you don't have that. I already had a bachelor's degree when I went to prison.
Yeah.
So I was kind of ahead of the game from most of the guys. And I grew up in a very sort of normal middle class kind of family, which was very different. I mean, many of them, not that my family was perfect, because it wasn't, but many of the men who are in prison come from very dysfunctional backgrounds where nobody is functioning properly and nobody knows how to communicate. And there's abuse and there's alcoholism and there's violence and there's all of this stuff. And they grew up in neighborhoods where the gang life and going to prison that's still rite of passage. That's just normal. That's what people do.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up with that.
No, it's literally, say that again. It's part of life for some people.
Yeah.
It's expected. Like, I was a youth minister in the East LA area, and there was neighborhoods near where my parish was where there would be people recruiting 8-9-year-olds that the recruitment would start into gangs. It's expected. You live in this block.
Right.
You're joining this gang, or else you're going to be physically hurting. We're getting you. And part of it is you're going to prison for at least a short time.
Yeah.
You're going to do something that lands you there.
And it's a rite of passage. It's like now I'm a man, you know? I was in a jail cell at one point with a young man who was facing trial, and they were offering him a plea bargain for probation, and he didn't want to take it. And I said, why would you not take this plea bargain? Why do you want to go to prison? And he said, all my friends are in prison. That's where everybody I know is.
Wow.
There's nobody I know out on the streets. Wow. It was crazy.
Yeah,
and
it is.
It's a whole different way of thinking. So, yeah, as far as rehabilitation, you have to seek it. You have to want it.
Yeah.
And most guys, look, everybody wants to be successful, but they don't know how to get there. And so they don't know what to do. And so they're not really seeking rehabilitation because they don't know what that means and they don't know what it looks like. I was blessed to have a family that taught me the right things when I was young, even though I didn't follow them. And I was able to find those things again. Yeah.
Praise God for that.
Amen. Go ahead.
No, so when you're getting out of prison and you want to reenter society, and you know that you've had this massive conversion, you're different, you're ready to be welcomed with open arms by society and rejoin everyone, right?
Right.
That's where the real fun begins.
Yeah.
And that this pain, and we'll come to this in a minute, but this is the pain that led you to start my father's house.
Right.
What do you experience when you try to reenter?
Well, again, because of my family, my reentry was much different than most men's. I mean, my family came down to pick me up at the prison, and they brought me home to my mother's home, where there was a big sign saying, welcome home.
Oh, wow.
And, my mom had prepared a bedroom for me. So there was a bed and a desk and a chair and a dresser and all of this stuff. And, you know, she brought me in and she said, this is your room. And she was obviously watching me very carefully. And she said, how is it? And I said, it's beautiful.
Hmm.
Absolutely beautiful. So, you know, those first days were good.
Hmm.
I will tell you, though, it's tough reacclimating society. It's not just tough finding the job, and that's a heck of a stretch. And it's not just tough like the practical stuff, but having been in prison for 20 years and around in a situation where you're constantly in fear of being attacked, your adrenaline is constantly rushing, you're constantly in this, it's almost like war. It's like that PTSD from war.
Wow.
Where you're, you know, you never know what's going to happen next. To come into a place where it's just me and my mom, to try to decompress from that, people say, how long did it take you to get past that and to feel normal again in society? I've been out 9 years, and I'm still getting over it.
Just learn to some extent. Reset the thermostat to relax.
There are times when I get into a big crowd, or I get into a situation that's very unfamiliar to me, and that adrenaline pumps again, and I can hear my heart racing, and wow. You know, my breath gets short, and it's difficult. Yeah.
So what's it like when you try to apply for a job and they're looking at your resume and, so what have you been doing the last 20 years?
Right. That's the question. How do I explain this last 20 years? And
does everyone just turn you down? Like, what kind of job can you get?
So, you know, I had a degree in music education.
Yeah.
At my bachelor's, and I had a master's in theology. Neither of which does me a darn bit of good when I'm trying to find a job as a convicted felon, right?
Yeah. I hear you.
Now,
can I teach at a high school? Can I work at a church?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Right? Even those settings, even a church setting is going to say, well, yeah, there's not much you can, that our legal team will let you do here.
Right. So.
Which is kind of a dang shame. Anyway, go ahead.
I'd like to tell you that I struggled horribly to get a job.
Yeah.
I actually got the first job that I applied for, but I always
Thank
get the
God.
First job that I apply for. So
Thank God.
I don't know what that blessing is from God that has allowed me. What I got was a job working for a call center, answering calls for some companies that you would know, and just doing customer service for them, making $10.50 an hour.
Okay.
So it was minimum wage, and it was a very low-level job.
I mean, a guy with a master's degree, another degree, but like that's pretty much the only thing you're going to be able to
aim for most of these
guys.
And most guys don't have the education that I had and can't do that. And so it's manual labor. It's digging ditches. It's holding the stop sign at the construction site, you know, doing flagging.
Yeah.
It's working in a warehouse, even though they might have all kinds of skills. Like they might have electrician skills or plumber skills or whatever, but they're not going to get that job.
And if you have no family, what hope is there for you?
Right, exactly. I mean, you wind up in a shelter somewhere, wind up on the street somewhere.
Yeah, you can't come out and get one of those jobs. It's hard to afford to pay your rent in Denver with one of those jobs.
Exactly. And it could take 2 or 3 months for you to land an actual permanent job. You might just be doing day labor for the first two or three months.
You're homeless for a little while.
Yeah, if you don't have anybody to help you.
I've seen guys recently released walking literally on the side of the freeway, or kind of a funny phenomenon. You've probably seen this running on the side of the freeway in their like prison outfit. You know, they're not dressed in regular clothes. Where the doors are open, there's no one to greet them, and they don't know what to do with themselves, so they just run. It's kind of a tragic scene.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when a guy gets out of prison and he's got no one to help him, basically they just sort of turn him loose and say, figure it out. And there are some resources, but unless you know what to do with those resources wisely.
And have hope.
Yeah, and have some hope that this is going to turn out okay. It's very easy to go right back to what you were doing. To go back to criminal ways that are the only ways that you know, and how to make money and how to live.
Yeah, how many people who are released from prison end up back in prison?
So the statistics are something like 60 to 70% of people go back to prison eventually for one reason or another. Yeah.
60 to 70%.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that could be for a new crime.
Yeah.
Or it could be for, you know, for a technical parole violation, but yeah.
What do we need to know about, I mean, people who haven't lived through what you've lived through? What do we need to know about prison inmates, people who were just released from prison? Because sadly, some people look at those stats and think, I don't need to know anymore. Everything that I've, all my preconceived notions are confirmed by that. I need to stay away from these people. They're monsters. They're whatever they are that can't become part of society. Living with these people for a long time, you see that they're human.
Right.
But speak on behalf of these people who often, you know, end up back there because of how all of society is seeing them. There's not an open armed welcome back in.
So, everybody wants to be successful. Everybody wants to have a decent life, right? I mean, we know that. Some people don't know how to do it. Yeah. And so, you know, men who get out of prison, they want to be successful.
So they're not much different than anybody else.
No, of course not. Of course not. Now, I do tell guys when I do, when I talk to them, I do tell guys, you know, there's basically two reasons why people don't do what they're supposed to do. Mm. One reason is they don't know how. They don't know how to get up every morning and do the next right thing. They don't know what the next right thing is.
Mm.
They don't know how to make a plan. They don't know how to discipline themselves and say no to themselves and to figure out how to move forward, you know, piece by piece. Mm. The other reason people don't do what they're supposed to do is they don't want to. Mm. They want to do whatever they want to do. And I would be lying to you if I told you that some of the guys that get out of prison aren't that. There are guys who get out of prison who aren't interested in doing what's right. They just want to do what they were doing before.
Yeah.
But that's not the majority.
You don't think it's the majority?
No. The majority of men want to do what's right, and they want to change, and they want to find this way forward, but they just don't know how.
Wow.
And they've got no one to help them, and they've got no one to teach them. Their families didn't teach them these things. Their schools didn't teach them these things. They don't go to church, so they have no one there to teach them anything. They see that as a judgmental place or a barrier or whatever.
Wow.
And so, you know, they don't have anybody to help them, and they can't figure it out.
Well, enter Jim Bloom into the scene.
Well,
yeah. A couple of scriptures come to mind. I love this scripture that God comforts us in our affliction so we can comfort others with the same comfort we receive from Him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow that? He comforts us and brings us through trials so that we can take the very thing that He comforted us with and use that to comfort others.
Right.
And I also love that He doesn't just do that for others directly. He wants to share the joy with us of being His blessing, you
right.
know? And then God makes all things work out for the good for those who love and serve Him. So even your experience of profound failure, right? And being the guy that you described was an arrogant man, an arrogant fool. Your experience of prison, like it's so beautiful, the redemption of God, that He rolls that into his plan. Like he didn't will that you do those things, but since you did, okay, I'm rewriting the script. This is part of the plan and the glory story. Like there's no point at which we can't make the U-turn out of where the direction we're going and get on that new script that's even better than it would have been had we not messed up. And that's the mind-blowing power of God.
Yeah.
And it's shown all over your life. So how have you turned your experience and reintegration and getting to know the prison system and the whole thing into my father's house? What are you doing for these guys?
So while I was still in prison, I spent a lot of time talking to other men because I was studying the human condition. I was trying to figure out why I did the things that I did. What makes people do these things?
Wow.
And so I would talk to guys. They would come to me. I guess they thought that I had answers to their questions, and they would ask me for help, and I would help them. But I took it as an opportunity to really just talk to them and figure out, why did you do what you did, and why did I do what I did?
Wow.
And I wanted to continue that. So when I got out on parole, while I was in that first year, I had 5 years of parole. And when I was in that first year of parole, at one point my parole officer said, what do you want to do with your life? What would be meaningful to you? And I said, well, I'm waiting to get off parole because I want to start a ministry where I can help other men coming out of prison. When you're on parole, you're not allowed to have contact with other felons. So you can't talk to any other felons, right? So I'm waiting to get off parole so that I can help the felons. And she said, well, what if I let you do that now? And I said, well, then I would start now. And so she said, okay. Later, she told me, years later, she told me, you know, when I told you you could do this, I didn't actually think you were going to pull it off. I thought you would just work at it for a while and it would give you some purpose in life. And
yeah.
So anyway, I was able to get some assistance from my sister, my oldest sister and her husband, to purchase a house. Mm-hmm. And I started to house 4 men at a time while I was still on parole. I was housing other men on parole and just helping them find a way forward. Because I will tell you, the last facility I was in, there were 1,500 men in that facility. And I got visits all the time from my family.
Mm.
And there were about 50 other men in the prison that I would see in the visiting room regularly. And the other 1,450 never got a visit.
Nobody.
Never got a letter. Never made a telephone call. Had no contact with anybody. And when they get out, there's nobody waiting at the gate. And there's nobody that's going to help them. And so my father's house wants to be that place.
That's devastating to hear that.
Yeah, it really is. It's very sad. And they have no hope. They say, I'm getting out. And I say, well, that's great. And they're like, yeah, I guess.
Oh.
You know. And they're planning to be right back, really.
Oh. So much is solved by just simple community. Mm. So my father's house.
Yeah, so I mean, it's John 14, 2. In my father's house are many rooms.
Mm, how beautiful,
man. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And that's what we're doing. We're preparing a place for these men. It's a physical place, a building with a room that for this guy. But more than that, it's a spiritual place. It's an emotional place. It's a place made out of relationships where the man can experience community for the first time in a healthy way.
Wow.
Can experience love and be okay with being loved and maybe even start to be okay with loving other people and caring about others, having some empathy.
Wow.
So the men that come to my father's house are the ones that don't have anybody else to help them. They're kind of the guys who are at that bottom of that situation. And so we're providing logistical help. We provide housing. We help them find work. We give them food and clothing and hygiene items when they first come out.
Wow.
I go down to the prison. Every time I go down to the prison and I pick the man up at the prison.
There's rather than having no one.
Right, right. I've done that 78 times in the last 7.5 years.
Oh, man. How many houses do you have now? How many guys in these houses?
Yeah, so there are 4 houses and a total of 16 men. So 4 men in each house. Every man has his own room. I don't want them to have to share a room with somebody. They've been sharing a cell with somebody for however many years. I want them to have their own space.
Wow.
And so everybody's got his own space, and they live with us for about a year, during which time they're getting reacclimated to society, getting that job, saving some money, and starting to feel like they belong in this community again, that there's something here for them that's different than anything they knew before.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many guys have gone through this so far?
78 men.
78?
Yeah.
What's the, 60, 70% of the average inmate ends up back in prison. What's the success rate been from these 78 men?
We have never had a man go back to prison for committing a new crime. Never. We have had some
high
men.
Five.
Yeah. We have had some men who've gone back for technical violations.
Yeah.
But no new crimes. And that's huge. These men are making different choices and different decisions. And they have
that's
the support
incredible.
To make those decisions.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the structure of life look like?
So the men are pretty free to live their lives. I mean, I don't have staff living in the houses, but we are in regular contact with them. They're in just sort of residential neighborhoods that are kind of working class neighborhoods. It's not one big facility. That would just feel like another prison, you know?
Yep.
So we want them to feel like this is their home. We try to make the homes very beautiful and very welcoming. So the guys, you know, when they first get out, they've got a lot of stuff they got to get taken care of. You got to get an ID. You got to get your Social Security card back. You got to get, your documents to work, essentially, or else you can't even look for a job. Mm. The prison doesn't do as well as they should with that in terms of getting those documents ready before a guy gets out. So we wind up having to do that. And first couple of weeks, the guys are just really getting used to living in the world again. I have guys who tell me, this bed is way too soft. I can't sleep.
Wow.
I have to move to the floor. Because
wow.
I can't, or it's too quiet. And I can't, I experienced that when I got out. It was so quiet that I couldn't sleep. Because you're used to hearing noise all the time. I had to get a fan and turn it on just to get some noise in the background so I could sleep. And then the guys, they begin to look for work. Many guys come out with some pretty serious medical problems. The medical situation in prison is not great.
Mm.
And so they come out with some pretty serious medical problems. We get them to see a doctor as quickly as we can. To try to start moving that forward. And then we start helping them. We put together a resume.
And you're doing this personal work with these guys?
Yeah.
The doctor, helping them put the resume together?
Right.
So you're fathering them, really?
In a way, yeah.
I mean, you're helping give them those life skills that many of them their dad didn't give them. And
I have staff that help. I have two full-time staff members. So, yeah, we're doing our best to help them. And I've got dozens of volunteers that help us as well. And we need more volunteers, by the way. So... but it's, you know, we'll assign like each man, we're trying to assign a mentor for each man. I don't have enough mentors for that right now. I got 16 men and I got about 5 mentors. So I need more mentors, mentors.
Yeah.
Men who are just willing to come along these guys and just walk the journey with them.
What's the website so people can reach out to you maybe to say, I want to be a mentor, I want to help out, I want to help in some way?
It's myfathershousedenver.org, myfathershousedenver.org.
You take inmates who are getting out from all over the country? If someone's watching, their kid's getting out?
So they have to be on parole in Colorado. That's because of the funding structure that we have, a fair chunk of our funding comes from the DOC. And so the rule is they have to be on Colorado parole. Okay. Now, you can get transferred into Colorado parole from outside the state, but we've never actually figured out, we've never actually accomplished
that. We need to spread this around the entire country, don't we?
Yeah, it would be wonderful. Yeah.
I mean, 100% success rate so far it's a pretty good record.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems like all of society might benefit from that being everywhere.
And the success is the men's success.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, they're the ones that are making the right decisions.
Yeah.
So
what are the aspects of it? And I ask this not just for those guys, but for all of us, because all of us are broken humans who are a little closer than we realize to falling into a dark abyss without God helping us.
Yeah.
Then our community that we take for granted, so many of us take for granted, saving us, right?
Right.
If you could boil down what's driving these men who succeed.
Yeah.
To a couple elements that maybe we could all adapt into our own lives.
The first is humility.
Mm.
The way I define humility is having a really good understanding of yourself, knowing what are my weaknesses and what are my strengths, and having a really good appraisal of that, and then knowing, so I've got these weaknesses and I want to work on those, and I'm going to make a plan to work specifically on growing in virtue and growing in strength to be better. And I'm going to use these strengths that I have to help myself and to help other people. I will tell you that, you know, you mentioned that I turned this into an opportunity to help others. Mm. That helps me more than it helps them.
Mm.
Me helping them helps me more than it helps them.
That's awesome.
You know, it's become, this isn't a job. This is my life's work.
Mm.
And it's something that I love to do.
Mm.
And it makes me a better man. But humility is at the core of it. And then,
which is the opposite of what landed a lot of them in prison in the first place.
And
thinking
landed
I
me
can
in
make
prison.
My own rules and do life my way. Yeah.
Yeah. And ignoring my faults and using my strengths for evil, using my intellect for evil, using my power, whatever it is, that's the exact opposite of humility.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Another thing that's really important is the ability to say no to yourself.
Mm.
Which isn't easy, and it's a thing that many of my men just don't know how to do it.
Basic self-control.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they learn that in these houses?
We hope so. We hope so, yeah absolutely. I'd like to say that they all come out the perfect picture model of a human being. They don't, but they're moving forward with their lives. I've got men who've purchased their own homes. I've got men who've been out for years and are doing well. They've gotten not just jobs, but careers. They've gotten back in touch with family. I got one guy who's, when he first got out, his mother said, look, I'm going to help you with the first month's rent, but don't give him my phone number. I don't want to talk to him.
Wow.
And I said, why not? And she said, there's just too much baggage. That guy, he was one of my first guys out. That guy still calls me every week and we talk, and he's reconnected with family. He's moved, near his mother because she asked him to. They spend time together. His life's just been transformed. And it's because he learned to say no to himself, and it was because he began to see that there's a different way of thinking about life.
Mm.
Yeah.
And a different way of thinking about himself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And your identity's obviously profoundly shifted. You're not condemned criminal. You are, you're a child of God and someone imaging who he is as father.
Yeah.
You know, when people ask you, what did you do? How do you respond? When people try to draw you back into, do you feel people drawing you back into old identities and feel like, no.
When they ask me what my crime was?
Yeah, hard pass. I don't need to go there.
Yeah. I've had people ask
me
that question.
By the way, don't leave it in the show notes because I'm not answering the question. It's irrelevant, but go ahead. how do you respond?
I for the most part, I will tell people what I did, but I ask them a question first. I say, I want you to think of the worst thing that you've ever done. The thing that you're the most ashamed of, that you would never want anybody to know. And then I say, do you want to have a conversation with me about that?
Right.
And they say, no. And I say, I don't really want to have this conversation either.
Yeah, good.
So it isn't, I'm not hiding from it, but it's something that I'm terribly ashamed of, and that I recognize the harm that I did, and that that harm goes on.
Yeah.
It's not something in the past. It's something that continues. And I've had men tell me, you know, some of the guys will tell me, you know, I did this thing, but it's in the past. It's done.
Yeah.
And I say, it's not done, and it's not in the past. Its effects are carrying on. And you should continue. Yes, you're forgiven by God if you've asked for forgiveness. And yes, maybe the guilt is erased, but that remorse and that regret should always remain. Mm. Because the pain is still there in the people that you hurt and in yourself.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm.
And yet, who you are is new.
Yeah.
Anyone in Christ is a new creation.
That's
true. The beautiful irony is that realization of His love and your new identity is the thing that gives you the power to bear the full weight of responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's not the opposite. It's not a shirking of, right?
Right.
It's like, I know I'm beloved, so I can actually sit here in regretting what I did. And
right.
Say, Lord, I give that to you. Which applies to everybody who's watching, you know. But you know, I'm sure there are lots of people in these neighborhoods who maybe want to drag people down to their previous identity or hold them captive forever. You know, what's the response when people say, okay, here's a halfway house next door now.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want that here.
Yeah.
How do you fight for the right to re-enter in a neighborhood?
So what we do is we try to be good neighbors, and we try to introduce ourselves. I introduce myself to when I move into a new neighborhood. I don't necessarily tell them what I'm going to do right away because I'm going to get a bad reaction to that. Yeah. What I want to have happen is for the guys to move in before anybody really knows.
Mm.
Because then what happens is the neighbors get used to them and they're just the guys living next door. And then when the information comes out that this is actually what's going on here, they're like, well, but I know that guy. And he's not any different than me. He just goes to work every morning and he's mowing his lawn on Sundays and he's just living a normal life. And so they begin, you know, if I walk up to somebody and immediately tell them I've been in prison and what my crime is, their reaction is, oh.
See ya.
But if they get to know me a little bit first and then I divulge that, then they're like, really? I would never have guessed that because I'm a different man now. And these men are different men now. They're trying to move forward and they're doing well. And when the neighbors see them, they're like, okay, that's just a guy, you know, and he's doing his best just like I'm doing my best to be a regular human being.
In need of a redeemer.
Yeah.
Like everybody.
Right.
How beautiful. What a great reminder. Worst kind of day in your line of work and best kind of day in your line of work.
The best thing I do is get a man out of prison.
Like literally pick him up.
Yeah. I literally go down and I pick him up. I've done that 78 times. It's the best thing I do.
Tell me about that. What's it
so,
like?
So, you know, I pick a guy up. Generally, I start off with a prayer. Ask him, can I pray for you?
So then, do they know they're coming to a house that's also
absolutely
you know,
that? I mean, I'm not forcing religion on them, but they know that I'm Catholic and that I'm doing this for religious reasons. I'm trying to show them the love of Christ. So I ask them, can I pray? And invariably they say, sure, yeah, let's pray. And then I tell them a little bit about what we're going to do that day. And then we take off. I'm driving 2 hours from Canyon City to Denver, and I just stop talking. I want to know what he's thinking. And so it might be 10 seconds and it might be a minute, but eventually he's going to start talking. And he's, first of all, he might have questions or he might want to tell me something. But it's always interesting what's the first thing on this guy's mind.
Mm.
It tells me a lot about him. And sometimes it's really practical questions, like where am I going to find work or how am I going to get, you know, food and... But many times it's also, you know, sort of bigger sort of existential questions. Mm. Or they just want to tell me about themselves. They'll just start pouring out their life story. And it's 2 hours from Canyon City to Denver. I do this on purpose. I could easily just tell the prison system, yeah, bring him to the parole office and I'll meet him there. But I would miss this whole opportunity to get this rapport going with this guy then.
Wow.
And so they tell me their whole life story for the most part. And they lay it all out. And I can hear their hopes and their fears, and I can hear their dreams, and they start to ask me questions. I navigated parole. I know how it works. I can answer the questions about what's this day going to look like. One guy was so panicked. He kept saying, well, what's going to happen with this? What's going to happen with that? What's going to happen with this? And I said, you know, I've done this, at that time I was probably 70 times. I said, I've done this 70 times. There's nothing that's going to happen today that we can't handle. Everything is going to be fine. Tonight you're going to have a bed to sleep in. You're going to have food to eat. You're going to have clothes to wear. We'll deal with tomorrow. Everything's going to be okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
How amazing.
Right.
And the greatest struggles working with these guys.
Yeah, the greatest struggles is when a guy is going astray and I'm doing what I can do and it isn't working. I'm trying to talk to him. I'm trying to encourage him. Sometimes I'm trying to cajole him or even sort of like coerce him into doing what he's supposed to do. I start with an invitation and a proposal of something new. If that doesn't work, then I start to sort of work it out with logic with him and have conversations with him. Eventually, I might have to say, look, this is the way this is going to be, or we're going to have a problem, yeah, and you're going to have to change. But when I simply can't get through, and I've had that happen,
yeah,
it's very sad because I can see this guy heading for the cliff.
Hmm.
And I'm saying, there's a cliff over there, and you're going to run off the edge of that cliff. And he's like, no, I got this. I'm good. And I'm like, you're not good. It's not going to turn out the way you think it is. And here's the thing about my father's house is my father's house is designed to allow men to make mistakes without the mistakes being catastrophic. I can fix a lot of stuff. I can fix stupid mistakes. I can't fix everything, though.
Yeah.
There are times when a guy makes a decision that's so life-changing for himself that I can't fix it.
Yeah.
I've had guys who quit a job that they've struggled to get because they think they got another job. And I'm like, wait, keep with this job until you're certain that you have this other job.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if this guy was living on his own and he didn't have our help, that would be catastrophic. He would be back on the street. He would lose his apartment. He would lose everything he owns because he doesn't have the money, right? And so that's the struggle that I have is when I'm doing everything I can do to help this guy and he just isn't listening. He's not getting it.
Literally, it's a contemplative moment for me. Mm. I can see the Father's heart as you share that.
Yeah.
As you share what goes on inside of you as you watch these guys.
Right.
And all the many times I've failed in life and that all of us fail, he's just saying, you know, if you would just listen to me, I'm inviting you home. I'm inviting you to do the right thing. I'm not here ready to condemn you and pounce on you. I just want my kid to be free.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that love.
Yeah.
And thanks for what you're doing. It's also a challenge to all of us who call ourselves Christian, because it's very easy to talk about loving the most unlovable people, to talk about going to the leper, the rejected, the abandoned. When you actually think about it, it's a profound challenge.
Yeah.
You know, like would you be okay with one of these homes next door to your house?
Right.
Because it's essential for bringing about the kingdom is just simply loving people and letting them be and welcoming them and giving them space to expand. And Matthew 25 comes to mind too, the final judgment. You know, whatever you do for the least of these, you did for me. And I love that Jesus associates himself with people in need. You know, when I was sick, when I was, when I had no clothes, when I was alone, you visited me. When I was in prison,
yeah.
God literally associates himself with the people you're serving.
Mm.
The people who have made themselves train wrecks by their own choices. Jesus says, when you visited that guy, that was me you visited. Thank you for helping us to see some of Jesus and the people that we would not only be dismissive of, but the people we don't even want to look at or be around sometimes. Yeah, that's the key. That's the key for bringing about the kingdom of God. It's simply loving people we're not comfortable loving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah, it is.
But
it is.
But it's beautiful.
Oh, it's the most beautiful thing.
Yeah, it's transformative.
Right? Love is transformative.
Yeah.
And you've been transformed yourself. So, and thanks for that witness too. Yeah, I'm grateful, man. Thank you.
Thanks,
brother. Thanks for sharing all that.
Thanks
all
for
that.
Having me.
Yeah, no. So there's some interviews where I feel like some questions. I'm taking a scalpel and I'm like, hey, what you show? Let's look at some serious stuff you've been through. And thanks for the vulnerability. Yeah. I love you guys. Thank you so much for watching. Changing the world can sometimes be as simple as making a decision to be the community that other people need. We all have that superpower, so make sure you use it in whatever way God's calling you to use it, and make sure you check out My Father's House Denver.
MyFathersHouseDenver.org.
God bless you. Thanks, man.